We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, a year after the U.S. Supreme Court banished abortion rights, millions of American women and girls face dire threats to their health and emotional well-being.
Women suffer from trauma that can rise to the level of torture, or in the case of rape, you know, ending up with this unwanted pregnancy, having to carry it to term. There have been women who have committed suicide because of unwanted pregnancies.
22 years after the Twin Towers destruction, we recall the first 9/11 in 1973.
Canada goes along with the moves at the Inter-American Development Bank, IMF, to cut off money to Allende's Chile. And then once Allende is overthrown, immediately Canada votes for IMF package, Inter-American Development Package, to Pinochet.
And Palestine Panopticon, Israel's vast carceral system.
It's a system that entails both arbitrary deprivation of liberty behind bars and confinement beyond bars. Fenced roads, checkpoints, barriers to movement.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Months after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Dobbs versus Jackson, overturning 50 years of abortion rights, millions of American women and girls face deteriorating access to reproductive health care. This is the finding of a group of human rights experts communicated in a recent letter to the U.S. government. Abortion services are now banned in 15 U.S. states and sharply restricted in 7. So are a host of other fundamental rights, the experts say, to privacy, bodily integrity, autonomy, freedom of thought, and conscience. Disadvantaged women and girls have been especially hard hit. Healthcare providers have been chilled, even in states where abortion is still legal. Threats of violence are common, and law enforcement officials are using electronic data to track and pursue women seeking abortions. Reem Al-Salem was the lead author of the letter. Al-Salem is a special UN rapporteur on violence against women and girls, its causes and consequences. I reached Reem Al-Salem in Amman, Jordan. Reem Al-Salem, you obviously see denying access, right of access to abortion and related reproductive and sexual reproductive health services to women, you see that denial as constituting a form of violence.
Yes, correct.
How so? Can you articulate this connection for me? Because we know about violence against women. Unfortunately, it's pandemic around the globe, and we know what the worst forms of violence look like. But how is it that denying access to an abortion constitutes an act of violence?
Yeah, so if you look at all the kind of consequences that denying the right of abortion brings about, first of all, as we say in the letter, there has been evidence that women suffer from psychological consequences, like psychological trauma that can rise to the level of torture. We have evidence that there have been women who have committed suicide because of unwanted pregnancies. There is also physical consequences related to an unwanted pregnancy. Sometimes because of medical, just physical conditions, the pregnancy doesn't turn out well. It becomes a danger to the life of the woman. But even if not, it can actually become a problem. If women then go ahead and still terminate the pregnancy, if they are in territory where there is a complete ban on abortion, as you know, they can be, as happens in the US, be charged with having committed infanticides, manslaughter, murders. This is, for example, the case in Indiana. Then you also have the issue of the right to life, actually, because if her life is in danger and she cannot take any measures, she might lose her life because of that.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, it's one thinks of the worst situations where women are carrying an unviable fetus or a fetus that's actually died and they got to carry it to term, or a 12 or 13 year old who's pregnant. This is a form of violence, forcing them to carry this fetus to term.
Exactly. Or in the case of rape, you know, ending up with this unwanted pregnancy, having to carry it to term can, of course, cause a lot of psychological form of violence. But I don't want to just talk about situations where someone, you know, has been sexually violated or raped and therefore or is in a dangerous life situation, but just the loss of bodily autonomy, having to do something that they really don't want to do, end up with a child that they don't want to have, can lead also to a lot of psychological trauma, right? And then there's a lot of other rights, fundamental rights that are affected that I think we should also not forget, which is the right to freedom of belief and opinion. You know, if I believe in the right to abortion or not, the right to freedom of religion, because of course, there are many women who also belong to religions where at least some form of abortion is allowed. And of course, they're entitled to either believe in that religion or not. But, you know, that's part of also of their belief cosmos or religious beliefs or faith scheme that it's okay to have an abortion. So why then be forced not to do that? And then I would say for experts or practitioners, medical practitioners who are now going through medical school, I understand that in some places in the U.S., some of this very fundamental, important information on abortions is being sort of removed from the curricula or the teaching methods. I don't know if formally or not, but we have received these kinds of reports as well. So from many different sides, the fundamental rights of women are being affected. And you could say that the impact is so widespread, intersecting, that all these violations together also rise to being to the level of violence.
And it isn't just access to abortion services that have been denied or are being denied. There are all kinds of reproductive healthcare services that go alongside.
Absolutely.
Or lead to that ultimate decision to terminate a pregnancy or not.
Yes.
And so have you found that access to sexual and reproductive health care services in the United States, generally speaking, has been hampered as the result of the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, so as we said, you know, one of the most widely available forms of abortion worldwide, you probably know this because of also your familiarity with the subject, is the medication abortion, right? It's sort of the pill over the counter, which, you know, makes it very easy to access it in a timely manner. You know, you wouldn't need necessarily, you can get it over the counter, you can administer it at home. So also the costs are kept manageable. So that is being affected. Getting information about abortion, you know, is counseling is getting affected. In some places, we have received information about delayed cancer treatments for women that have cancer until the fetus is older or has been born. So there is another form of risk to life. You have the regular, cervix smear tests that women have to do regularly. That will also get affected. And then because of this fear that physicians have, there is a reluctance to also then actually take a decision that an abortion is necessary, even when they see the conditions being met, that the life is in danger, that the fetus should be removed through an abortion. And also the whole issue of then removal of fetal issues in the case of incomplete pregnancy. Again, because of the fear of the consequences for the physician or the medical staff, it may lead to these things then being kept in the body of the woman or delayed. So it's a whole myriad of things that get complicated and that are related to each other.
And women who spontaneously abort, which is really common.
Yeah.
From the earliest stages to later stages. It's now in the United States, in these states where 15 United States where there's been a full ban on abortion imposed, You're in danger if you spontaneously abort.
Yes, exactly.
If you have a miscarriage, you're in danger.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, women who miscarry spontaneously, who need to go to the hospital in states where there's an abortion ban, what happens to those women?
Yeah, so what we understand is, of course, many women will have to decide to travel to states where abortion is legal, and that has led to a flood of women frequenting these clinics.
Even if they spontaneously abort, they've had a miscarriage,
yeah,
and they need to go to a hospital, they've got to travel out of state?
They have to travel out of state, or they might resort to aborting using unsafe procedures, doing it underground. So that brings a lot of complications. And then, of course, for women to travel anywhere, as you know, they might not have the economic means. They have to put all sorts of arrangements at home for this to happen. You also know that, let's say, if a woman wishing to abort is also in an abusive relationship, that makes it also more complicated for her to take this kind of decision or to be able to travel. So, yeah, all these issues are affected, yeah.
But, I mean, aside from deciding they want to have an abortion, what happens? Are you aware of situations where women have spontaneously aborted? They've miscarried, and they need to go to a doctor, and they happen to live in Alabama or Mississippi or Arkansas, and they've spontaneously aborted, and they're in crisis? What happens when they go to the hospital, if they do?
I don't have sufficient information on that, but one can imagine that coming forward as having aborted, knowing that you might find yourself in an unenviable situation or might be treated as a suspect of having committed, a crime, would discourage women from coming forward. I can just sort of imagine that being the case.
You mentioned in your report that the Supreme Court decision also had a chilling effect on doctors and healthcare workers who may face legal consequences for their care decisions. Are we now seeing that? Are we now seeing physicians and healthcare workers in the United States, in these states where there are full bans, facing legal consequences for actions they've taken?
I'm aware of them being incredibly concerned about this. There are a number of NGOs, of course, that are monitoring this or institutions that are monitoring this much more closely than I am. For example, the Center on Reproductive Rights in the States. So they might have more information about that. But as we also said, the consequences are not just, or the fear of the consequences is not just from being sued, let's say, either by a patient or an interest group or the authorities. But there are reports also of violence being committed against persons that are providing abortion services or are perceived to provide them. So, for example, my understanding is in 2021, the National Abortion Federation reported 1,464 incidents of violence against abortion providers across the U.S. And that has included reports of extreme forms of violence, and some have died also as a result. So that's also the other concern with the decision by the Supreme Court, is that, of course, it further emboldens the perpetrators of acts like that.
And you say in your letter that law enforcement officials in the United States are increasingly relying on electronic data to track those seeking abortions or those who aid and abet them. And much of this data can be accessed without a warrant. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, so, we all use communication means where, for example, it tracks where we've been, right? Where, it can tell you where we have gone. And also through social media. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I understand there are ways of tracking you to know if you visited an abortion clinic or where you have been or what you have done. So that is being used against people.
And are you aware of instances where somebody, a woman or a healthcare provider, was actually identified, tracked, and held to account by authorities who obtained electronic data based on surveillance?
We understand that it has happened. Yes.
Huh. And you also indicate that Some clinics are now refraining from providing abortion-related services, even in states where it remains legal.
Yes, yes.
So this chilling effect is actually crossing state borders.
Yeah, so as you know, David, especially I think for women and girls that have recently immigrated to the U.S. or that might not be able to fully speak the language or that don't have legal aid readily available, the legal landscape right now when it comes to abortion in the U.S. is very confusing, right? And it's still evolving as we speak. So even in states where there is a full abortion ban, there are appeals being filed, you know, and it's just happening constantly and all the time. So I understand that also for clinics and service providers, this is also a very destabilizing situation that therefore is confusing. Therefore, they want to play it safe. They're scared of the consequences. Perhaps today this is legal. If we talk about this, perhaps tomorrow it won't. So they therefore err on the side of caution in a number of states.
And women in disadvantageous, women and girls, young women in disadvantageous situations belonging to minority groups, yes, are disproportionately affected by these bans.
Yes. So in the letter that we wrote to the U.S., we spoke about the profile of some of these women that would be really disadvantaged. And many of them, of course, already suffer discrimination on multiple grounds. So we spoke about women that are refugees, that are migrants, that are low-income women, women with disabilities, women, for example, from rural areas for whom also traveling would be costly, would be problematic, would be logistically not feasible, Black women, of course. And so they would have it even more difficult than others. But in the end, I think it's important to remember that irrespective of the background of the women, it's clear that the denial of the right to abortion is traumatic and problematic for women of all backgrounds. In fact, I don't know if you know, but in February this year, there was the Texas hearing for the Center for Reproductive Rights case, Zurawski versus the state of Texas. And they had five women that had come and told their stories about what this ban has done to them and to their lives. And it exemplifies really the suffering of ordinary women, really, in the U.S. They've talked about their near-death experience. One talked about being sent away from the clinic when her water broke, about going into septic shock, about ending up in intensive care, which is what had happened to Amanda. You know, what I'm saying is what happened to Amanda Zurawski, of, you know, near vomiting on the stand, basically recalling the death of a baby who lived for just 4 hours, as happened to one other lady, Cassiano. So it's a problem for all profiles of women, but especially for certain groups of women.
Reem Al-Salem, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me, David.
Reem Al-Salem is a special UN rapporteur on violence against women and girls, its causes and consequences. Listen to our complete conversation and link to the text of her and her colleague's letter to the U.S. government at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Time of year again. Time to commemorate the 22nd anniversary of 9/11. It's also time to commemorate the first 9/11, 50 years ago, on September 11th, 1973, in a brutal coup backed by the CIA, Chile's democratically elected socialist leader, Salvador Allende, was ousted and then killed Over the following weeks, 100,000 Chileans would be detained in Santiago's National Stadium. Thousands were tortured, killed outright, or disappeared, all under the beneficent gaze of the Nixon administration and its chief intellectual, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. North of the U.S. border, Canadian officials were also pleased. Indeed, in cooperation with Washington, Pierre Trudeau's government helped destabilize Chile's economy. Eve Engler has written extensively about Canadian involvement in the Chilean coup. Engler is a political commentator and writer based in Montreal. Hello, Eve Engler. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Thanks for having me.
Eve, it's an interesting convergence of historical events. On September 11th, Americans commemorate this dreadful assault upon the Twin Towers in New York City and on the Pentagon in Washington. 30 years earlier, another 9/11 happened, September 11th, 1973, an event that would lead to dreadful human rights abuses, an event that would have enormous historical significance. There may be some folks out there who don't know what happened on September 11th, 1973, and some folks may simply need to have their memories refreshed. Can you tell me what happened on September 11th, 1973, down in Chile?
The military, led by Augusto Pinochet, overthrew the elected president, Salvador Allende, a Marxist, and it was a very brutal affair. This was certainly no bloodless coup. This was sending the tanks in to ultimately kill, or it's unclear exactly, but Allende's dead at the end of the day, and his supporters are being rounded up basically immediately and tortured and detained and killed immediately in the hundreds, and then ultimately into the thousands killed. And you have a kind of a remarkable break in the political trajectory from Allende to Pinochet, whereas Allende was working to gain greater benefits from the country's, specifically its copper, but its resources in general, and was trying to distribute resources towards the poor. Pinochet went in the opposite direction and basically went from sort of a socialist experiment towards a neoliberal experiment fairly quickly. And it also shifted Chile's role in terms of promoting a new economic order that was not led by the G7, but that was more oriented towards the formerly colonized countries. And of course, Pinochet went in the opposite direction. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of a profound anti-democratic measure that had quite not just very significant impact on Chilean history, but significant impact on global power relations and inequities in the world.
And what was the Central Intelligence Agency's role in fomenting this coup? And Henry Kissinger's role, the Nixon administration's role, particularly Henry Kissinger in fomenting this?
Well, this was probably the best detailed U.S.-backed coup. And it didn't just begin when Allende was elected in 1970. He had run in the previous election and done fairly well. And the Americans funded the opposition, the main conservative opposition political party, against Allende's forces. They funded, you know, newspapers, famously El Mercurio, establishment newspaper, right-wing newspaper, very anti-Allende. They basically tried to bolster the opposition forces. That, you know, they backed unions that were truckers' union that worked to destabilize the elected Allende government. They basically bolstered the forces that were willing to go along with their anti-democratic measures that were hostile to socialistic transformation. And they tried to basically make the economy scream, I think was the famous words that were used, that basically tried to destabilize the Allende government by forcing, pressuring, you know, shipping companies to jack up their rates on insurance and the like that were exporting commodities from Allende's Chile, cutting off assistance via the Inter-American Development Bank, IMF, basically doing everything you can to make Allende's government not function. And then, of course, once Pinochet takes power, those policies are reversed. And all of a sudden, you have Inter-American Development Bank assistance, IMF assistance, and all kinds of other more covert forms of assistance to institutions under Pinochet's military rule. So it was a full throttle campaign. And Kissinger said famously something to the effect of, why do we have to sit aside and let Chileans vote to go communist, basically saying that the aims of the U.S. empire were far more important than the wishes of the Chilean population, which, of course, speaks to the fundamentally anti-democratic, elitist character of U.S. Foreign policy.
Did the CIA and Henry Kissinger have a direct hand in plotting the coup? Were they in communication with Pinochet and coordinating events with Pinochet prior to the coup?
Yeah, the CIA was you know, working with right-wing forces in Chile for years, you know, before Allende was elected in 1970. They were working, coordinating regularly with right-wing forces. There was a whole process of having Brazil, the military government in Brazil, and of course there was a U.S.-Canadian-backed coup in Brazil, against Goulart, a social democratic reformer, a few years earlier, to have Brazil be the first country that recognized Pinochet. The U.S. didn't want to be the first country that recognized the government. So they had a whole process planned out beforehand to, you know, sort of make it look like this wasn't just a U.S. affair, to have Brazil be the first country to recognize the Pinochet dictatorship. And Canada was recognized the Pinochet dictatorship within 3 weeks. There's no proof that was, you know, coordinated. I haven't seen any documents saying that was coordinated with Washington, but it probably was. So the Americans were deeply tied in with Pinochet. All phases were coordinated with Washington as part of a broader policy of controlling not just Chile, but controlling the whole region.
And were Kissinger and Pinochet in communication with each other prior to the coup?
I'm not sure if Kissinger was personally in communication with Pinochet or if it was via the U.S. Embassy and CIA officials on the ground. There was all kinds of coordination with the U.S. and Australian, for instance, CIA officials and Australian intelligence officials in terms of how they were interacting with Chilean officials. So they would coordinate to, you know, in some cases it was preferable not to be directly involved. And there was all this coordination with Australian secret intelligence officials. But depth of the U.S. involvement was down to the level of what I think what you're hinting at is the planning element. And yes, it was involved in the planning element. All the specifics. One of the things that's come out, the current Chilean government has requested of Biden. We have a sort of a social democratic government, Boric, in Chile right now. And they've requested of Biden, as part of the 50th commemoration, to release all of the documents. There still are many documents the CIA has released, but there's still lots of documents that haven't been released. And so there is a push from the current Chilean government to have the Biden administration do that. It's not clear if that's gonna happen, because we're now getting, you know, close to the date. Wouldn't surprise me if the Biden administration doesn't want to amplify attention on the U.S. role on the 50th anniversary by releasing documents right now. But yeah, so there's still a push to demand further release of all the documents, pertinent documents.
Now, what were Canada's interests, quote unquote, interests in Chile prior to September 11th, 1973? Economic interests, mining interests, and what was Canada's role in the lead up to and following the coup?
The Canadian government's interests, I'd say, as this is sort of the general pattern, are both interests of empire being aligned with the predominant empire, the, you know, historically the British, but today the U.S. And so basically a government that's breaking away from the established order is a threat to Washington. And so Ottawa, as part of its alignment doesn't want to see that. And Allende was pushing against multinational corporations and pushing for non-alignment.